This is the Climb to Space.
Hello and welcome to the Decline to State Internet Radio Stream, the show which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Decline to State is proud to bring you in a surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. You can find us on the web at declinefm.com, Decline to State on iTunes, Decline to State on Facebook, and r/declinetostate on reddit.com. Make sure to check out older episodes, check out some terrific rants and interviews, and see just how far we've come. Today we have a guest who will be able to lament the state of the state with us, but who will also be able to give us some tips on how to be more successful in our own lives. I am Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of Silicon Valley. I'm joined by my handsome co-casters, and I'll let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
Hi guys, this is Eternal. Welcome to the show.
Wrong opinion here, broadcasting from the Rust Belt. I hope you're all doing well.
And all right. I'm pleased to announce, sorry, Joe, we have Corey, who goes by John Tesh on Reddit on. Among other things, he has co-founded an e-commerce company. He's an angel investor. And also importantly, I think it's fair to say that he likes freedom of choice. Welcome, Corey.
Thanks, guys.
So to start off, I think we're all extremely interested in you before you got to be a successful businessman. Where exactly did you start from? Did you go to school for anything in particular?
You know, I had when I was a kid, my parents both came from a less than well-off background, and you know, being a kid in the 80s, there's all kinds of stuff, Transformer toys, you know, Ninja Turtle toys, that it seemed like everybody else had. And as I would try to get my parents to buy these for me, and we didn't have any money, they offered sort of, hey, why don't we help you figure out how to make money, whether that was cutting grass or, you know, buying and selling stuff. And I think that that had a lot to do with it, that, you know, by the time I was 13, I was making, I had a couple $1,000s in the bank, which isn't huge, but at the same time, you know, I think it was the foundation upon which I kind of built to be able to do the things that I've done so far.
That's really good. Of course, I have to ask now, since you mentioned Ninja Turtles, what's your favorite Ninja Turtle?
I've watched some stuff recently that makes me want to totally retract my ever liking Ninja Turtles. I think the franchise has been bastardized, but it was Donatello at the time.
Yeah, that's my favorite too. Yeah,
he's like the phlegmatic computer nerd one, or I can't even remember.
No, it was you know, actually, I just was really accident prone as a kid, and I cut myself on a pocket knife quite a few times, like trying to learn how to sharpen stuff. And so just the idea of having the stick, like it seemed like longer range and you can't accidentally cut yourself.
you could probably accidentally hit yourself in the nuts though, if you weren't careful.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure I would manage that. So yeah, it sounds like, I mean, you've kind of lived the stereotypical American dream, which is you're coming from humble beginnings and you just worked hard, you know, since day one, pretty much to build up yourself into what you are today. I think that's fantastic. I think that many of us want to be able to emulate that. Did you ever feel that you were kind of lost for direction when it came to starting the business, when it came to running things in the early years? Or did you always have a good plan that you stuck to?
Yeah, that kind of strikes at the heart of it. I think a lot of times first off, I want to say that it's not like everything that I've ever gotten is totally a result of only me, right? I mean, I believe that that there's a good deal of luck involved in it, but I feel like if you're not trying to be at the right place at the right time and putting in that effort, then you are less likely to be lucky than you otherwise would be. But, you know, certainly I could have been born in another time or another place or had any other number of factors happen that would have been, you know, drastically different outcome. And then by the same key, you know, the people around me, both from a friend standpoint and from a from a partner standpoint, from an employee standpoint, business partner standpoint, you know, even my wife, the support really makes all that happen. But, you know, I think there's a pretty big disconnect between vision when it comes to what you're trying to do with a business or an organization and the day-to-day, you know, how do you translate that into this is what I'm going to do. And as an organization gets bigger, you know, when you have two or three people, it's not that big of a jump to go between them. But when you get to the point where you have layers of management and potentially people in, you know, different buildings with different schedules, with totally different backgrounds, all trying to figure out how to communicate and work on something that's really not as concrete. Like in the beginning, you know, hey, we have a few sales. And now we need to focus on shipping these things out today so that everybody gets their stuff. Now it's how do we build an organization that fosters self-improvement for employees without being too preachy, gives them opportunity to better themselves, but at the same time, you know, provide more value for customers than our competitors would. And, you know, how do we do all that with kind of staying true to what it is that actually drives us? How do we specifically say, you know, here's sort of the magic. We're going to define the magic behind what we're doing. And then we're going to try to stick to that. And then every day we're going to try to come up with a much more concrete set of tasks, or, you know, every week we're going to come up with a much more concrete set of goals than making people happy. But at the end of the day, stay focused on making people happy, both customers and employees. And it's tough. You know, I think persistence, is important. I think, you know, I've been going on for a while. Either one of you guys want to jump in?
Well, I'll jump in really quick. It sounds like, I mean, these are all the same hurdles we've kind of gone through at a very smaller and less important level with the show itself. Coming from day one when I put this together, it was just an idea, and the idea was, you know, get people together of, you know, coming from a similar background to discuss ideas that people find interesting. I mean, it's a very broad spectrum, and market, of course, you know, towards the Reddit crowds, especially those on the Liberty boards. And what we've done is, you know, slowly but surely fix up, you know, technical issue after technical issue, and, you know, made the show structure, you know, different. Pretty much like every other week we have a new change of the show structure to make it better. And go ahead, Ron.
I was gonna say, I think it's safe to say that we've kind of run into what he was describing to a little bit. He was initially talking about how are we going to make this get shipped, or how are we going to make this get done as the small group of people that are all kind of interacting face to face or on the phone, you know, working together. How are we going to make that happen? You know, just kind of grasping how you're going to make this work, get out of the door, to the point where you have people kind of working autonomously to get things done, and you're looking at not just this, you know, drive to get something off the ground that everybody's kind of tied together on, but you have people, you know, with concepts like being stable or intrinsic motivation, or just kind of be happy and advancing for themselves, who aren't necessarily tied into the organization. They don't have their finger on the pulse. So it's, you know, they kind of are independent people working within it.
And another thing I wanted to add, I don't know if, you have any experience trying to I'm sure you tried to combat this a little bit. I don't know. Your company is only, what, 70-some people? Your main company is only, like, what, 70-some people? So it's not huge, but it's not small. And I know the really larger companies, sometimes it seems like after a while when they grow, they lose sight of that initial vision, and it seems to be driven by all sorts of independent parts moving in all different directions without any real central focus to bring them back together. I've seen this a lot, and actually, you know, the funny thing is I see this a lot in video game studios, and that they seem to suffer from it really badly. I'm just thinking Blizzard Entertainment being one of those companies that just lost their way somehow as they grew. So have you experienced a lot of frustration trying to keep vision while maintaining that kind of growth and prosperity?
I don't know if it's a revenue number, if it's a number of people number. But there's definitely a point where all of a sudden your responsibility is to lead by stating or making statements, making speeches, doing things that provide examples of the vision, the values, as opposed to the one who rolls up your sleeves and just deals with problems. And, you know, it's two different kinds of leadership. And I think it's for two different sizes of company. But essentially, you have to inspire your middle management to be the guys who roll up their sleeves and lead by example.
or the girls who roll up their sleeves and lead by example. And then you also have to make sure that they understand what you're doing enough to where when they are in the trenches with their employees, that they can communicate the same message, even if it's implicitly, that you did when you were the leader, you know, of a handful of people. And I'm sure there's going to be a next level that's even more complicated, but I haven't made it there yet.
It's like you're describing in Inception or meta levels of communication where you have to kind of keep in mind what that was like and describe it well rather than just kind of, you know, being in the thick of it yourself, but also being able to kind of communicate just with words. It probably feels a little bit disconnected or farther away from what it was before.
Your largest business is an online retailer. I guess we're kind of curious about what the similarities and differences with the online experience versus the in-store experience and things you've observed that are going to be different in between going shopping in the virtual world versus having to have employees do direct interaction in a real store.
So oddly enough, I don't like shopping at all. I really like cooking and entertaining. And that's sort of the, you know, the rough tangential market that we serve. But we also have an online and an offline store. So I think I'm more confident talking about what we try to do and what I see, you know, from a back-end perspective about the differences between the two than how I think about it being the shopper, because I actively avoid being the shopper as much as possible.
Yeah, I want to hear about the back end and what goes on behind the scenes.
So the storefront retail, you know, the brick and mortar physical presence for us feels a lot more like what you expect when you think of retail. There's, you know, there's a bit of an immediacy because people are actually there that we don't necessarily have on the online side. But there's also the training aspect. You know, you can't say, hey, let me get an answer for you on that by tomorrow, or, you know, can I call you back in 30 minutes with that or something. You know, 15, 20, 30 minutes is not an awesome customer service time. It's a terrible customer service time. So from a training perspective, you have to have people who obviously know more than the average person about that particular type of product. And then what we try to do is we try to hire people who are actually interested in those products, you know, want those products, have used those products in the past, or even maybe even professionally, and kind of have a passion for cooking, so that when a customer's talking to them, they can offer ideas about the usage of the product, not just, you know, oh, the specs are this, we have three in stock, but telling stories about, you know, well, I like this product because when I bought it, I was doing this, and now I do this, and it's made everything so much better, and that kind of deal. But coming from a place where they actually mean it, you know, we're not just making it up. And the way we go about doing that is we have a heavy investment in the like demo model type stuff, and we buy the food for people, pay them for the time to learn how to cook on, you know, using any number of different products that we have, and we also sell anything that we have to our employees at cost. And then we also, like, if we get, you know, if a vendor gives us demo stuff, then we'll kind of distribute that out in between employees because we want them to actually have this stuff in their house. And then
that's really cool.
And what it's done is it's made us, I think, even better with our call center and some of the other stuff that we do online. And so we have, it's not as regular as it used to be, but we're still trying to figure out the right schedule. But we have a requirement for the marketing team and the call center team to actually rotate through the storefront, because I think there's some value to, even though I realize it's anecdotal evidence and it's not statistically relevant, just dealing with one or two customers and kind of getting the real person feel, because at the end of the day, a website's still selling to people, but it's very easy to be in a marketing office where you never actually interact with a customer in any way, shape, or form. And I think that that's, you know, that starts to get dangerous. So it's the storefront is much more obvious what we are, what our value is to the customer, or what the customer thinks that we have as a brand promise. And so by cycling people through there, I try to get as much of that kind of channeled back to the online side as I can.
I think it's good that you have your employees familiar with the products and actually give them incentives to do so, because a lot of the time I've noticed in my own online shopping experiences, even when I go to ask questions about a product or something like that, I feel like I'm talking to a robot, and sometimes I probably am. And you can get the information you want some of the time, but that extra bit of human touch definitely does make a person more likely to buy, I think, or at least come back later and check out products from whatever company gave them that human element there.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, we even have a chef on staff who does nothing but going over products, talking about what he likes about them, what he doesn't like, doing recipe videos, and kind of going and spreading the love of the joy of cooking or whatever between the employees. So not to say that everybody on my staff knows everything about every single product, but you know, we want to have that. The stuff we sell is very complicated, and we know that as a customer, like, that's not fun. You know, you're buying this stuff because of the time that you expect to spend using it, not because you want like some kind of giant spreadsheet where you're comparing all these features. And so, you know, we tend to be, we're a content originator. We don't just take, you know, manufacturer specs or somebody else's description and put it up there. We actually build stuff from scratch, and a lot of times find mistakes in manufacturer specs and that kind of deal. But the reason we go into that level of detail is because we want to be able to kind of figure out all that stuff and then say, you know, based on the way that you want to use this stuff, here's the stuff that's important for you. Here's how to filter by it. Bam, you know, done, and avoid cognitive dissonance as much as possible. Cause it's very, I do it quite a bit. If I buy something, man, I should have got the one that does this way, you know, X, Y, or Z. And that detracts away from the enjoyment of the product at the end of the day. And we try to help people not go through that as much as possible.
Yeah. And Corey, you're probably aware that when, you know, there first started to be a glut of products in the economy and people had lots and lots of more choices, things that economists would observe is that people would actually be less likely to buy when they're presented with too many choices. I don't know if the threshold is like two or three or four things, but at some point, like, we become overwhelmed with the choice and the complexity of it all. And the way with internet shopping, I know even for me is I'll go on and I'll, I was looking for like a computer bag or something for work this last week, and there's just, you know, hundreds upon hundreds of different reviews, and that might be, you know, they might have found a cheaper way to get that information or get more information about the product just by kind of pulling it out of other, you know, customers and kind of encouraging them to submit. But I think it sounds like what you're describing for a lot of people condenses it even more, distills it into this little, you know, a person-to-person interaction, which is good. And I, you know, even despite the cost, I guess, you know, you having to go through the effort to, you know, hire people, find people that actually are interested in that kind of stuff and give them a salary is probably not, you know, there's actually a cost associated with it, but it sounds like it's been worth it for you. And that's kind of cool to hear that the, you know, the market for things is going in that direction.
I also wanted to expand on something. It's interesting because I think most people don't realize, and this is just, it's a cultural thing you see nowadays, and it's really unfortunate, which is that there's a huge sentiment that business owners they only care about money. They only care about profits. They don't really care about what product is that they sell. And you're like the exact opposite of that. I mean, you have a chef on hand just to make sure that you guys understand how your products work and you can relate to your customers and make sure they know exactly what they're getting into. And I think people don't understand the importance of that relationship, which is that, you know, if I'm like a salesperson and I sell you something that you really, really like, you're going to go back to me. You're going to trust me. The relationship of trust, and you can build on that. Even if you don't make a huge amount of profit on the first thing, the fact that you've built up a repeat customer, a relationship of trust, I think matters way more than people realize.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I would argue that that's the whole reason we exist. I mean, you know, that we, at least on the retail business, we don't manufacture stuff, right? I mean, we stock it to the extent that we have to stock it to have it available. But really, our value in the supply chain is helping you figure out how that stuff's relevant to you or which one is the best for you. So if we don't do a good job of that, we should go away.
Right, right. Speaking of interfacing with people and helping them find what they want, there's a lot of places on the internet that provide that service. And, you know, the company that you run is just one of probably thousands. Do you think there's some oversaturation as far as internet retail goes, or do you think there's still quite a bit more room in the market to be taken up by other competitors?
You know, I think up until probably like 2006, 2007, somewhere in that neck of the woods, there was the opportunity for people to just throw stuff on the internet and then sell at least a little bit, as long as they got it in all the shopping comparison engines, you know, Frugal or Google Base or Google Shopping or whatever you want to call it. And I really don't think that that's the case anymore. But as far as if there's still room for somebody in the market to come in who's not there now, make an impact, I would say definitely yes. But it's going to have to be somebody who cares about being an authority on the stuff that they're going after. You know, like, I don't think somebody's going to hop online and knock Target.com out, like, boom, done, now I'm the superstore. That's not going to happen. But, you know, could somebody who really cares about product category X come in and do something better than this, what's being done now? I mean, absolutely. I even see in our own company, there's sort of a, every few years, we have to check ourselves and say, man, are we still making sure that we're taking advantage of all of the technologies that are out there and all the ways that people expect to interact with us? Because even all of that stuff that we have and all that investment that we have going into trying to build this great, you know, this great environment, if we're not, if people want to consume that information in a way that we are not delivering it, then all that stuff could very well be for naught, even if it wasn't 2 years ago. So does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that what you're describing is that there's increasing specialization in the internet retail market. You mentioned that there's, you know, you've got Target, and there's also places like Amazon, for example. But it would be very unlikely for some young gun to pop in and you know, knock Target or Amazon off of their perch. But with your business, for example, you market mostly home appliances and cooking equipment and other things like that, and you do really well at it. And I've noticed that there's other internet retail sites that focus on things like for example, firearms or camping accessories, like Cheaper Than Dirt, for example. That's their domain, and they're very successful at that. So there's going to be increased specialization. I think that's really where the market is going. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. And I think that there's, you know, there are brands that are going to distinguish themselves as low-cost brands. There are brands that are going to distinguish themselves as experts. And there are brands that are going to distinguish themselves as being something quirky. And I think there's opportunity on all of those fronts. You know, I mean, there's, you can look at Dollar Shave Guy or Dollar Shave Club Guy. I mean, that's a $30 million business in less than a year, from what I understand. And I would, if I'd have been given this interview 2 years ago and I used, you know, Gillette as somebody you're not going to knock off, I would have thought I knew what I was talking about. But then that guy comes out of nowhere and makes a serious dent and makes real money in a market that I would have called saturated, but that's not my market. So it's a good thing I'm not in it.
Yeah, I think it's really important to emphasize what you are talking about here, which is that there is room in a market for various tiers of quality or particular flavors of a product. Just because, you know, you have a bunch of people make, for instance, like shoes, you have, you know, your $5 whatever cheapo Target shoes. What are those, Crocs? Is that what they're called? How much do those things cost?
Yeah,
like super cheap. But yeah, you have things like that, and then you have your really high class, you know, Rockports and even more expensive shoes, their dress shoes and such. And of course, people are going to buy shoes based upon what they're looking for. So you don't have to appeal to the whole market at once. You can kind of carve out your little niche there. And this is something I think that the general public doesn't grasp about capitalism very well, which is the idea that you can make a whole lot of money marketing stuff for really cheap to a lot of poor people. And they don't seem to understand that companies won't just make things, you know, so expensive that, you know, nobody can really afford them. It's a typical argument. You hear this a lot, which is that, oh man, we need to have like prevailing living wages and this and that, because companies need to be able to pay their employees enough that they can afford those products. And like the employees, if they demand stuff, they're going to get something. Because there's a huge amount of people that don't make that much money, and if you can sell a cheap product to them, you can make a lot of money just on volume. So you get guys like, you know, what is it? Well, the Walmart's guy, I can't remember his name to save my life, but you get Walmart going out there and doing exactly that. And they made fortunes, probably billions of dollars at this point. So I think that that's something which people need to understand, is that there's different tiers of quality, and there's no reason why, you know, there can't be a company that tailors to one group of individuals and a company that tailors to another in the same vein.
So to the point of capitalism and pricing, you know, one of the manufacturing business that I'm involved with was started to take advantage of a customer segment that we expect the average order size to be much less than it is on our online retail business. But we think that that's drastically underserved, that there are a lot of people who want to pay price X and just don't have the money to kind of move up into the next price bracket, but yet want something a little better quality than the next price bracket down. The demand is exceeding our projection, and every time we increase the projection, make more stuff, we still underestimated. So, I mean, that's not, we don't have a decade of experience in that yet by any means, but, you know, to your point, we figured, like we said, all right, if we bring the average order size down and sell a lot more of it, we think we can make more money. And then those people have a product that's better quality than anything they could have got beforehand at that price point. I view that as a win-win, and I hope that those customers do too. And I think that that's why they're giving us their hard-earned money, right? Clearly they're saying, I value the stuff that you have more than I value this many dollars, or else that transaction wouldn't happen. And if we were wrong about how many dollars they wanted to spend, then we would just have warehouses full of stuff and we would not be having revenue. And then the second thing is that the people we compete with, we pay about 60 to 70% more for a line level entry, you know, no experience employee, than all of those people that you would think of in terms of a chain, you know, a national chain or a luxury retailer that has something to do with cooking. And again, you know, we think that that's because we do demand more of our employees, but there's nobody that makes anywhere close to minimum wage in our company. And, you know, that's, if somebody thinks that they have to force a living wage on us, that, you know, they would have to go way, way higher than what it is before it even started to impact that.
Oh, you don't sound like the typical greedy monocle toting capitalist that I usually hear about. So it's breaking my worldview a little bit.
And real quick, I mean, I guarantee you that you can find at least one employee who, you know, thinks that they should make more money and that I should make less money. I mean, I think that there's some part of that that's part of human nature. It's part of the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. But we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we can make things better for our employees as well as our customers.
Yeah, and I'm sure the same goes for them. They're trying to figure out how to add more value and stuff like that. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that as an aside. I'm kind of half in jest, but it's a good point to bring up, because there's so much human nature that goes in to try to make an organization. What I was curious about, because we were talking about, you know, trying to predict the markets and the nature of them and finding gaps that you can exploit or you know, go in and provide value in. You even mentioned that, you know, and I was in the same boat. I thought that Dollar Shave Club, I was kind of taken off guard that there was a new entry to that market. But when you have, you know, a new window, a new niche you're looking at for people that, for, you know, looking for cookware, was there ever a time in there? And you could give us an example from that, or maybe from just, you know, from your life, from your general overarching career. But were there times where things weren't looking so good, or it didn't seem like it would pan out? Like, how would you handle that? Would you start like kind of planting the seeds of doubt in the people that are closest to you? Would you just kind of like, you know, I don't know, go for a long run and take a breather? How do you kind of deal with that kind of struggle? And is that something that's commonplace for you?
Yeah. So I think that there is a common thread among business owners with whom I'm friends, that there's an internal struggle to figure out what is actually going on versus how do you feel. I've noticed that I have a tendency to swing between everything's great and this, you know, I have the best, most fortunate life in the history of the world, and the sky is falling and burn everything, and, you know, coming to change my name and move to another country. But you know, I think realistically, it could never be as good or as bad as I think. But there is definitely a balancing act, and it's very frequent. It used to be every single day. You know, you wake up in the morning and you say, "Oh my God, how am I going to do it? How is this going to happen?" And then you just do it anyway, and you keep doing it, and then eventually you get that once a week, and then eventually you get that, you know, maybe once or twice a month. But I certainly don't. I internalize the negativity as much as possible. You know, I don't know if any of you guys are runners. You mentioned running, but there's a trick I like to play with myself, where, you know, all right, I'm just going to get to the next traffic light. And then when I get to that traffic light, all right, I'm just going to get to the next traffic light. When really I know I'm trying to push myself to do an extra couple of miles that I wasn't originally planning on doing. I don't know how to share a negative assessment with a group of people who are not in a situation to understand it. You know, even if it's management employees that have been there for a long time, they need to believe in you. And I mean, if you have the right people, you're going to get through it. And that's really what it comes down to, is just telling yourself, listen, yeah, this might be bad, but is it worth this effort? Because if it is, I'm going to do the effort 100%. And then if you get through it and it worked out great, great. If you get through it and it did not go the way you wanted, then at least you know there's nothing that you could have done to try to make that go better, and then make sure that you learn from it so that the next time you're faced with that, you can do a better job. You know, fortunately, we haven't had anything that has failed so greatly that it sank the company. But we definitely have failed and wasted tons of investment on multiple projects that didn't work, and that's really depressing.
It's part of the learning process. And I think it's funny what you said about, you know, give it your 100%. That goes to the bottom of my favorite characters of all time. Ron Swanson says, you know, don't half-ass two things, whole-ass one thing. So make sure if you're going to do something, you want to put forth 100% effort into it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And when I eat, it is the food that is afraid.
It's the food that's what?
That is afraid. It's another Ron Swanson line, but
nice.
In his AMA, he mentioned it was his favorite line he ever spoke.
That's great to know. Yeah, with running, I do it for fun, never, you know, not really competitively, or do it for training for other sports. I played volleyball, but for me, the just going just that next step, that didn't really work for me. For me, I always used to like pick like an arbitrary point of the real goal, like I picked like 75% of it, and then in my mind, I would convince myself that was like getting halfway done. So I couldn't feel like I had done even halfway until I'd gotten like most of the way there. That was kind of a weird trick. But also, you know, speaking about kind of carefully grooming your own mental state, like it's a Japanese garden. I guess a lot of that you have to do and insulate the negativity from other people. But I've heard in a book I read, I know this one's popular, and I'm not sure how good you would consider a lot of his advice, but there's the guy who wrote the book, The 4-Hour Workweek. I forget his name, Tim. But he talks about, you know, I guess a trait of being successful, or one of the mindsets you want to be in, or people like that tend to be in, is always kind of being a little bit uncomfortable. You know, never, you know, if you're in any comfortable state, or you're any state of complacency, you're probably not doing the right thing. Do you think that also goes with it, or are you just trying to kind of dampen the highs and dampen the lows and just keep pushing forward? Is that kind of one and the same?
Yeah, I don't know that those two are diametric positions. It goes back to the Dollar Shave Club guy, right? If you're comfortable and you've been comfortable for a while, that means that you're probably leaving money on the table, or you're leaving, you're not keeping up with time, and time is providing a weakness that other people can use to gain market share, if you mean from a business standpoint. But from a personal standpoint, I like to think of it more as, you know, if I focus on always improving myself, I was thinking about this morning at the gym. I'm 5'6". Like, if I stand up straight and fake it, I'm 5'7", right? I'm not ever going to be the strongest guy in the room. But I can work really hard and make sure that I'm never the slowest, I'm never the weakest, I'm never the dumbest, I'm never the worst looking, right? Like, and every day I can get a little bit stronger, a little bit faster, a little bit smarter. I can learn something new. I can be a little bit closer to wherever I'm trying to get than I was yesterday. And then, you know, hopefully that gets me where I need to go. But you can kind of start to be comfortable in a state of always being, of always changing. And I think that, and that's actually one of our company values. And the way that we state it is, how can things get better if they stay the same?
That's an incredibly awesome mindset. It's almost borrowing from the, it's the field or the practice of mindful meditation, is that you just kind of accept that things are always changing, and you take it one further, I guess, and say that they're going to change for the positive, or look at it that way.
I remember Bruce Lee saying something to the same extent, which is that, you know, he's never satisfied with where he is, and the whole point is to push yourself just that one step further and always improve. And I really like that kind of philosophy. I take that to heart too.
Yeah, so our DBA has a picture of Bruce Lee taped up above his desk, and it has a story that somebody else wrote about him, that this guy was going, whoever he was going jogging with Bruce Lee, and Bruce Lee was like, well, today, how you feel about doing 5 miles? And he's like, man, Bruce, I would die if I ran 5 miles. And Bruce Lee said, then die. And his point was, if you're not moving forward, what are you doing?
That's, yeah, I like that a lot.
I think it might be a little harsh, right? Like, I don't think you actually have to die if you're not moving forward, but you should consider maybe thinking about trying to improve every day if you could, rather than choosing not to.
No, I think you should die.
Ron's a meanie. He's a grumpy old man. He's the oldest one here, probably. Well, no, not okay, other than you, he's the oldest host here, I think.
He's a social Darwinist.
Yeah. He's a crotchy old man. I was gonna say, I think the whole moral of that thing is that, you know, if you're not trying to move forward, you might as well just be dead, because, you know, that's the point of life, is to keep improving, according to Bruce Lee anyway. And I kind of identify with that myself, so hopefully it'll yield good results in the future. I'm hoping that kind of thing.
But the trick is, you know, the trick is then refining your definition of improving too. I mean, it's never a set course. Like, you don't, you know, all right, point the mass towards X and then just truck it that way as fast as you can. It's you could very well go very far before you realize that you're going to the wrong destination.
Indeed.
And that's what's been really interesting, and I was, now that you mentioned that, be curious what your thoughts are, is that finding that direction is something that I felt, and I think a lot of people feel like we're so left without that ability when you go through our prefab, say, public education system. I know it's something we, you know, people in the libertarian community like to rant about, but I think it's, you know, to a degree it's fair. It's, you're just pointed towards getting this diploma or getting this or getting this job, but you're not really defined in that direction. And really, when you're being an entrepreneur, where you're starting something out of nothing, and you have, you know, that's all of it. That's, you know, you have to find out what direction or what place to go, because it's not something that was there before.
Yeah, if we're trying to transition into whether or not we like public school, I definitely have a lot of problems with the way public school is taught. But, you know, I think in the same way, it took me forever to graduate from college. I was not always well liked by public school administration when I was in school, and I think I could have got a lot more out of it though if I would have had somebody kind of help me put all that in context, to tell me, hey, this is how you can benefit from it if you choose to, and the way that you benefit is you learn how to play the game without actually having the game change your mind. And I think you know, both from seeing what people are susceptible to from an organizational standpoint, and also, you know, when you have that teacher, that coach, that whatever, who has a general interest in improving the lives of their students, you know, building a relationship with that person and actually learning from that person. I think I would have got a lot more out of school. I actively hated school until I was out of it for quite some time. You know, I kind of hope that, you know, since we're all going to be forced to put our kids through school by the man, that hopefully I'll be able to make that suck a little bit less for my kids than it did for me.
And we advocate on this show, we talked about this a lot, because schooling is like one of the biggest pet peeves of everybody here. And one of our hosts is currently undergoing certification to become a teacher. And it's a big topic in general. I know we've talked about alternative forms of schooling. You know, both private models, which are different than just the standard Prussian style public school system, different education models, and then homeschooling and unschooling as well. And for the listeners who are going to listen to this, you guys can check out those casts in the archives on education. They're pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up a perfect example from, you know, from me. I don't even remember what grade it was, but it was before junior high, so I was fairly young. I had one teacher that I absolutely hated, super strict. But her whole thing was she was never going to give you homework, and you could learn whatever the hell you wanted at whatever pace you wanted, as long as it was, you know, from it. Obviously, she had to stick to the textbooks that the school board put in place. But that year, just because I didn't want to have any contact with her, I was like, I'm going to just get busy, focus my mind on something, and just try to avoid dealing with her at all. You know, I went through like 3 or 4 years of math book. And then it wasn't until the next year when they made me start over on like the math book that I was supposed to do for that grade. I was just like, you know what? I don't even care about school anymore. But that I didn't realize at the time what she was doing. She was making sure that I did all, you know, hey, this is the time to learn. And then it's time to go be a kid when you get home. And now I see my nieces and nephews being stuck with like 4 hours of homework, 3 hours of homework a night, or however much ridiculous it is. And it's, man, I don't know where you're expected to learn to be a kid and like do outside stuff that makes you not like after a natural disaster, I had to rebuild my house by myself, like with my own hands, you know, and I'm not a carpenter. But if it wouldn't have been from living in the country, building a barn, dealing with horses, all that stuff, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to do that. And if I was inside 5 hours a night with homework, I would totally not have those life skills.
I don't have those life skills. I'm doomed. Push my rent. Yeah, no, it's so true. And I heard something, this is a bit of a tangent, but I actually heard that France was considering banning homework. Like there's some legislation that's going to say no homework will shall ever be given.
And, that's awesome.
You know, they never do anything right in France, but this actually is a good idea. So I'm curious to see. Probably won't go through because it's a good idea. So I'll take a look at that and see what happens. And I also know there's a lot of research out there that homework has a negative impact on students' ability to learn and performance and everything. So
In other news, and apparently free online education is now illegal in Minnesota. So if you want to go online and get it for free, apparently that's no longer okay.
Unacceptable.
I think that got turned back around, actually.
It's a weird kind of a strange regulation, which I guess can segue into one of the questions I wanted to ask as well. But yeah, the regulation is, I think it's something where universities that offer any accredited university that wants to offer stuff into Minnesota has to get some approval from some board, and it costs like a couple hundred to $1,000 or so. So the universities that offer the content into this, I guess, nonprofit website that's going to put all this stuff up there for free, to in order for that website to make its make its content available to Minnesotans, whatever that really means, is they're either going to have to get the universities to pay something to this Minnesota government agency. It's completely ridiculous. And of course, like, how are you going to actually keep the people in Minnesota from getting to it? So the website puts up this hilarious notice, like, if you're from Minnesota, you can't view this website or something. And I actually think it's really funny. You probably get the message across that the government's completely ridiculous sometimes.
Yeah, that reminds me of the after the BP oil spill, one of the, you know, Denmark or Norway or somebody wanted to send over skimmer ships that can clean up 99.9% of the oil and just shoot the water out the back. And the reason that they couldn't use those ships is because there's some kind of EPA regulation that says any kind of emissions from your ship has to have less than X parts per million of oil. And so since the stuff coming out the back was less clean than the regulation, they couldn't actually do it. But anyway, that was an aside.
No, sides are welcome. I mean, putting this together, we've explored the depths of tangents, and it's fun, and sometimes it definitely adds to content. but speaking of people that we might not want to work with or being in situations that could be harder, more trying, and you described that teacher of yours, and in retrospect, you're able to learn or see what she was trying to do for you. I've heard people say that when you're starting a new organization, when you're trying to get off the ground or make yourself kind of future-proof, that counterintuitively, I guess at least counterintuitively in what it can feel like for people, you're not searching for people that are necessarily like you. You're not looking for a, you know, clones of yourself. You're looking for somebody who you might not hang out with in, you know, social circles or on the weekend with a friend, but I mean, you very well could, but you're looking for people that have skills that you don't. You're trying to find something that they're offering different. And is that something that you've, I guess, sought out explicitly, or you've done yourself, where you're like, okay, this person has a strength that I don't, or in this person, you know, and I have some strength this person doesn't. So you not see eye to eye in everything, but you know that you can add value to each other in each other's lives.
Yeah, I think it's hugely important. So when we started the online retail company, the two other people who had a brick and mortar store before that kind of I came along to turn in, you know, we turned into an online company when I came along. But the I think one of those people was sophisticated enough to be aware of that, and I think I just happened to take advantage of that. But learning from that, absolutely. I think it's very rare that, let me say it the other way. It's quite frequent that I will be wrong, and it's quite it is not rare that Mike will be wrong, but it is very rare that both of us are wrong at the same time. And so that's, I think that's hugely, you know, huge benefit of something that I don't know how to duplicate that with just one person. But at the same time, we definitely come from looking at things from two drastically different places. And, you know, there's an opportunity or there's a potential for that to get sort of heated every once in a while. But, you know, I would say we've had maybe a handful of times where, you know, things got a little hot between us past just, you know, disagreeing. But that was nothing recent. It's been a long time ago. We've learned how to work with each other. And I think that, you know, together is a much better deal than either one of us could have done independently. So I'm and we look for that in key employees now as well. Yeah, 100% very important.
Yeah, that's cool to be able to say, and also very humble to say that, you know, you might even be able to observe that he's right more often than you feel you are.
I mean, he has, you know, 15 years more experience than I do, and I frequently, if it's a problem I don't understand, you know, use him as a resource to bounce stuff off of. And you know, I'm definitely, it's very possible that he's right more often than I am.
Yeah. do you find, I guess maybe people that aren't cut out for this or not as interested, I notice myself that sometimes I'll be able to see things in other people. I'll say, oh, this person is better at this than me, or this person has this skill. And then I also will think like, hey, I can add this. I have this ability, this strength that this person might not see. That, I guess, communicating that sometimes can seem hard. Like, you know, because the other person will see what they're good at and look at it in you, and you're like, oh, this person doesn't think as well as I do. You know, say if someone's got a good, got good decision making skills, or can make, you know, snap judgments, and you know, and say I'm not that guy. You know, is it? Did that, I guess, maybe an example with that one guy, was it hard to kind of show where your value was for him, and, or vice versa, or did it just kind of come out?
No, I think on the front, initially, I think he was the sophisticated one, right? Like, I think he saw a compliment in terms of my skill set, and it took me a while to figure out that was kind of what he was going for. But, I mean, where the arguments take place is sort of the space where you both disagree, but you both think you're better than the other person. I mean, I've never really thought about that before, but that has to be it, right? Because if I know he's better at, you know, XYZ stuff, and I go like, hey, man, what do you think about XYZ type stuff? And he's like, this, and that. I mean, I'm going to go with that because I know he's better at it, right? The only time that we would have a source of friction is if we both have different opinions on things that we think of. We're the better one at, but it doesn't happen often.
Indeed. Cool. So what I'm getting at this is that when you start a business, you have to be like the Justice League, where everybody has their own superpowers, and you kind of combine and work together to tackle big evil galactic problems or something.
Yeah, absolutely. But it definitely helps to be like, if you have two Supermen and they're not allergic to the same element, that's way better than having like 15 Aquamen, because that's not all that useful except for one specific thing, you know.
I call Wonder Woman for this show. Just saying, because I'm fabulous looking.
She would be handy though. She already has a private jet that saves the corporation like millions of dollars a year.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah. We can go go fly anywhere. Vegas, maybe.
It just goes to show you how important specialization of labor is. You can really bring costs down through that.
Yeah, I mean, if you're building an organization, then you should get to a point where you're not the one doing all the work, right? And so having very talented people who, you know, can do predictable categories of work makes it very easy to separate responsibility across the organization and then have those people sort of be in charge of that silo of responsibility as it goes from being one person to 25 people to 50 people. And then even worst case scenario, if that person in charge of one of your silos doesn't have the sophistication in terms of people skills to inspire and to analyze and to interpret human behavior, then they can still serve as sort of the overseer or like the wise sage of that department, and you bring somebody else in who can do, you know, the management aspect. So you still have somebody at a high level that you can trust that's ultimately, you know, sort of in control of the quality of that silo. So yeah, absolutely.
All right. Yeah. I'm gonna throw you something which might catch you a little off guard, but hopefully, you know, you have a good answer for this. So I've seen stories of people working for quote unquote the man, complaining about how awful their job is and how much their managers suck. You see that a lot on Reddit. People talk about how much their job sucks. They hate it. So, you know, if you're the guy at the top, you're looking down at this and you see, you know, this friction between employee and manager or employees, you know, what is your approach to reducing that friction? What would you do?
You know, we spend a lot of time working with managers on making sure that they understand the difference between the sending of a message and the receipt of a message, and that things can be interpreted in multiple ways. And that as a manager, you know, you're going to be ultimately the impact is making sure that the person you're talking to understands the stuff in the exact same way that you meant it. But it is not that person's responsibility to have the exact same mindset that the manager has. So the manager has to be the one to accommodate that, to say, all right, you know, where is this other person coming from? How does this other person generally take things? How do I communicate in an effective manner? And we spend a ton of time on that. If you're talking about me personally, if I hear a conversation that I don't think is going the right way, I will listen to it, not be involved in it, wait for it to be over, pull the manager aside and say, hey, I just, you know, I don't like the way that that went over. I don't think that person understood it in the way that you think they did. Here's what I think that person meant, you know, took it to mean. Here's what I think you took it to mean. Here's the way that I think that the communication broke down. You know, let's figure out how we can approach that person, have that conversation again without undermining your managerial authority, and then sit down and say, you know, I can serve as the arbiter, arbitrator at that point.
Arbiter's good.
I've never actually had to say that word before. It's weird. I can serve as a neutral third party to say, hey, I know that both of you guys were upset about the way this conversation went, but I know that neither one of you guys had the intention to, you know, insult or, you know, disobey or whatever the case is, the other one. So let's have it again. You know, y'all go after it, and I'm just going to be here to try to help with the communication between you guys so we can open up that as effective in the future when I'm not here and 1,000 other conversations y'all are going to have in the future.
That sounds good.
Sounds like I'd be a good boss to have or a good manager to have. I'd sign me up.
It sounds to me like you almost have to play a little bit of Freud there. You know, you have to kind of put yourself in their shoes and see what everybody's thinking. And so, you know, a good business owner does need some semblance of empathy and understanding of different people's personalities to be able to make things like that not explode into horrible situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for us at the end of the day, you know, I make it clear to my managers that I expect them to facilitate the people underneath them becoming better at any given aspect of that department than the manager himself or herself would be, right? Like if you're the best at, you know, making widgets, and then all of a sudden you got 15 people under you, I need you to make them better at making widgets. And if you're holding them back, you know, oh, I don't want to be overshadowed, you're not going to make it very long. But if you're like, hey, I don't know how to do it, let's figure it out. Then we give you the tool set to do that. And, you know, same thing. If the people are like, man, this is awesome, I wish I could learn how to make whatever better or more widgets or whatever the benchmark is, you know, making sure that the manager gives them the tools to do so. And then everybody feels like the whole organization is working to help them, which that's kind of the point.
That's really good. So yeah, I know that you're also, I guess, on some economic board for small businesses. I forget the name of it off the top of my head. I have it written down somewhere, but
yeah. So that's kind of an experiment. The state does has a pilot program for economic gardening, and so I am the token entrepreneur on the advisory board of that. But essentially, it's they're trying to gather all of the, you know, public, private, nonprofit, every kind of resource you could have for a business owner, and have all that, have like a repository in one place. So, you know, you as a business owner could come in and say, you know, I feel like I need this, and then they can, you know, they can guide you down the right path. It's still a little bit too early to tell how that's working out, and I kind of have mixed feelings about it. It's sort of like one of those, do you shun the system, or do you try to improve it from the inside type debates. That's very, feels very weird.
Yeah. I'm almost picturing you as like the Peter Schiff going before Congress, kind of situation where you could just kind of be talking and there wouldn't be very, very many ears that are actually hearing what you're saying.
So it's kind of funny because I actually have, I have been to DC and, talked about small business and technology issues. And it turns out that no one likes hearing what I have to say, but no one is insulted by it. Both from a large corporation standpoint and from a Senate standpoint, you know, it's like, I think it was something to do with Google's impact on small business and how that ties into, you know, subsidies for building out communication lines. and so people would ask me questions and I'd be like, well, if you're talking about giving all of this stuff the short-term net benefit of just adding Google, then here's the thing. But I wouldn't extrapolate that so far as to say we should subsidize building, you know, rural fiber optic lines. So you could just see everybody like, oh, why are we even talking to this guy?
So they pretty much just, they really just kind of wanted you to go away, but they weren't really willing to outright say it.
I think it was, you know, they'd never heard somebody try to be that concise about an issue before, and it didn't really fall into any bucket. I really felt like, and again, I don't have tens of years of experience or anything in it. This is my 3 days in Washington and what it felt like. But I felt like everybody sort of expects you to have one of a handful of opinions.
Yeah.
And then they just react to you based on that. And then whenever you have an opinion that they've never heard before, they're kind of like, oh, that's neat. But then 5 minutes later, they're caught up on something else and they're, you know, they've already forgot whatever the hell you said. And it's not, they don't put you in the column of this dude's behind my spot. They don't put you in the column of this dude's the enemy. They just say, oh, that was interesting. And now I'm distracted and I'm on to the next thing.
That sounds like 3 days was all it took you, because that sounds like my understanding.
It's kind of like if they can't plug you into their machine and you can't be plugged into the other guy's machine, then they kind of don't really care. They just kind of chug right along.
Yeah, right. Like if you're at war and you're like counting how many tanks the other guy has, and then they're like, but we have a bunch of swimming pools. Like that's not useful in the war. Like who cares? We don't care how many swimming pools.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that you were involved in some and a thing to help small business owners. You mentioned as well that you participate in something called angel investing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I do a bunch of stuff to help other small business owners, but angel investing in general, just kind of I'm a part of, to my knowledge, the only angel fund in the Gulf Coast region. The idea behind it is there's some point in your business where, you know, you don't really have the assets that you would need to go to a bank to get a loan, but you're not in the, you know, you don't have $20 million in revenue and you're not looking for X million dollar raise from Sequoia Capital or something like that. You know, we sort of, the angel investors in general just kind of bridge the gap. I think even with us, we're probably smaller than what you would see from an angel investment in, you know, California, New York or something like that. You know, where we are, seed money's typically tens of thousands of dollars, angel money's typically hundreds of thousands to close to a million, something like that. And then, you know, venture capital would be millions. That tends to be, you know, the sort of the amounts that are expected at those levels where I am. But the idea behind it is, you know, if somebody has a great foundation or, you know, if they have a great team and they need guidance, but they also need money, We are our fund is managed by the members, so we all get involved in checking out each business. We then mandate that we get a board seat, not to harass somebody, but to act as a as an advisor, because it's in our interest for that company to do well. We try to structure deals in such a way that people understand very, very much what they're getting into, but that we offer more than just here's some cash, come back when you have $1 billion. It's, here's some money. Here are all of the contacts that we have as a group, which, there's 40 guys in the group, and they range from, I'm the youngest guy by quite a bit, but they range from, upper levels of academia to serial entrepreneurs to, to corporate guys. So in terms of the golden Rolodex, that's a lot of what we bring. And then industrial, like the knowledge of that industry, we tend to not take investments if we have no background experience from somebody who's already in the fund, who knows what it takes to build a business in that industry. And so it's sort of, if we both, if a business comes to us and we both decide, hey, this looks great, then we set up guidelines, if you reach these criteria, you get this much money. If you reach these criteria, you get this much money. We set up, we obviously give them a round of funding and then, set them up with the guidance, the schedule, the check-ins, all the stuff that they would need to make that stuff happen. So it's kind of exciting. I joined it to learn about what it looks like to invest in a business from the other side. I've learned so much from doing that in the last 2 years that, man, it's incredible.
It sounds like an outrageous amount of fun, actually. I mean, at least to me, it sounds like a ton of fun. It sounds like an amazing experience. And yeah, I think that, it sounds like for you guys in general, it's not just about making money. It's about, being sort of a mentorship and also doing something where you can take your expertise and kind of give back to other people and create, better markets and more opportunities for everybody else.
Well, I mean, I think there are some people in the fund are looking at it directly as an investment, and they can get involved as much or as little as they want. Some people look at it as investment; they pay in, they do all their votes by proxy. Hey, whatever the executive committee thinks, just count my vote in with that, and whatever, just make me money. They have other people who are more active. Hey, look, all this touchy feely stuff's great, but step one, steal underpants. Step two, ? Step three, pop it. That's all I care about.
That's so funny. We were talking about that pre-screen.
Well, and then they have folks who are, who are actually kind of looking for something to get excited about. But I don't think there's anybody in the fund that's actively, doing this weird Bain Capital stuff where, all right, we're going to take them over, then we're going to leverage the assets, get all this payback stuff. Like, that's not what our term sheet looks like. If things go south and we go to bankruptcy, then yeah, we definitely move to the front of the line to get whatever we can get back out of, our investment. But it's not, we don't go in with the intention of looting somebody. We go in with the intention of growing somebody. And that's, I hope that's the difference.
It sounds like you guys provide a great service to a lot of people that really could use the help too. So, there's mutual benefit, of course, because it's a market interaction. So that's always good.
People seem to get a negative stereotype of any kind of investing, I guess, adventurism. They kind of get the image of Romney pointing the guns of Bain Capital at people and firing off a round, and suddenly 1,700 people are out of a job. But it really isn't necessarily that way with this angel investing thing and similar stuff like that. What you're really doing is person A has $1 million that he doesn't know what to do with it, and person B has a really awesome idea, and they come together and make something awesome happen. And, that's 99% of the time, that's actually what goes on. And if it wasn't for that kind of symbiotic relationship, boy, I don't know how many things we'd be without in this world.
Yeah, and one thing I keep seeing on Reddit is, capitalism's bad, and you don't need investors and blah blah blah. You could just deduct all your expenses. Man, that blows my mind, because the stuff that's really expensive is not, is not your pencils and paper office supplies. I mean, capital investment can be structured all kinds of ways where, depending on what's going on, it might not even be in your P&L at all. You can have something depending on the type of equipment. You could have it depreciated over 20 years. You know, it just blows my mind. And then the idea that, like, what if you need it made ahead of time? You know what I mean? Like, what if you know something's going to happen next year, but you need stuff ready to roll next year? Yeah, you can write off expenses. You write off cost of goods sold when you sell the stuff, but you don't even have the revenue at the time that you're making the stuff. And, like, the disconnect between all of that stuff, I mean, it blows my mind. I don't even know where all these people get it, but
I know they haven't run a business, that's for sure. At least most of them. I can't imagine any of them have ever done any serious, you know, business investing. They don't know. I mean, it's just, it's ignorance. And I think, I hate to bring it up again, but I think it has to do with the fact that in our school system, we don't talk about business. Like, only a few places in the country seem to even offer economics courses, much less, I'm guaranteed they're not mandatory. And I'm sure the economics in them isn't even great to begin with. But, you know, there's no real understanding of what it takes to build a business. Entrepreneurship is just absent completely from our education system. And it blows my mind, because what is this country founded on? The idea of entrepreneurship. So what the heck is, what's going on? Where's the disconnect? What is this?
You know, you think they would have a class on, like, personal finance or something that might prepare them for the actual real world?
I remember we spent 2 weeks, and when I was in high school, my senior year in my government class, we spent 2 weeks, and I put weeks in quotes because we really spent like about 2 hours on the idea of personal finance. And what it came down to is a bunch of things that basically say don't take out absurd amounts of debt and don't spend money you don't have and use credit cards intelligently. Like, that's not what we really need. Like, that helps some people maybe a little bit, but not really. What we need is people who understand the way businesses work so that they can go out there and feel comfortable, take their own ideas to market, and also feel better about being part of the, being a cog in the wheel, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I want to make, just to be clear, I don't mean to insult those people individually. If it was just one guy, then yeah, he might be being ignorant, but that information, if it's the same from, you know, so many people, it's got to be coming from somewhere. And if it is, you know, whether it's the school, whether it's a, you know, like whatever the opposite of Fox News is, I don't even know if that's a thing, but you know, wherever it's coming from, it's that source that really should be ashamed. I mean, that's ridiculous. And if you don't know about something, you shouldn't talk about it.
You get all agreement here. And speaking about that mind-bending misinformation that we run into in the greater Reddit community, rather than just rail against it all the time, we like to have a little bit fun. And towards the end of the show, we usually have a question with our guests where we call it Bizarro Mode. So rather than kind of say the things we've been saying, why don't we turn that around? So say if you were the greedy capitalist, say if that was actually you and those, you know, their concerns of the greater Reddit's concerns of what that was and what that meant. If you became that person, if you had no compassion for your clients, if you just were purely modeled on greed, if you had no empathy, what would you do for your customers? How would that change your business model? If you had to go out and say, all of a sudden, I actively loathe the people that I'm trying to serve today, how would you change things?
Essentially, how could I leverage shadiness to make as much profit as possible?
Pretty much like the Frankie.
You know, I don't know how long somebody would work if you were being just overtly fraudulent. So I don't think it could be anything that simple. But, you know, maybe doing something like adjusting, you know, building codes and, you know, and requirements for like rental assistance and other kinds of any kind of assistance programs to where like getting stuff that almost, you know, almost exactly matches the specifications of the stuff that I sell have to be done in order for these things to take place, and sort of going about trying to figure out how to increase that more and more, I think would probably be the most likely way to really have an impact on revenue. Because everything else, like if I sell some stuff that doesn't work right and I kill my customer, that's not, you know, that ain't going to help nobody, even if I'm being super shady, man. And then if I just take their money and don't send them stuff, they'll kind of catch on to that game, right? So I think it would really be leveraging a regulatory structure that essentially, you know, they talk about phishing in such a way where you set up like a wide net in a V in front so that when the fish swim in, right, they can get into the net, but they can't find that opening again. And once they're in the net, they can't figure out how to get out. I think you would do that over time with a regulatory structure to make sure that maybe not in year one, so it's not obvious, but year 10 or 15, you know, you're selling all kinds of stuff to everybody, because anybody that wants to renovate a rental house or build a new home or do XYZ, run a restaurant, they got to get stuff that meets these criteria, and then work on making sure that there's only a handful of places you can get that stuff from.
It's like something that Atlas Shrugged in a way. It's all, but you know, the thing is, like, that's how it really works in real life. Like, you took the approach, like, you can't just kill your customers. And that's like way too easy. It's not gonna work. You know, they'll catch on to that, really. They're not stupid. So yeah, I think that, you know, you could take it one step further, and, you know, maybe not just, you know, capture a bit of a regulatory agency. Maybe you should, you know, try to get an appointment or run for office too. You know, if you really want to get yourself rich at the expense of other people.
Like Monsanto style?
Yeah, Monsanto. I was thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah, I was actually getting ready to make that same joke. I was like, well, you know, I did used to be a lawyer for Monsanto, so maybe I should go get appointed to FDA.
Yeah.
For what that's worth, though, man, again, going back to anecdotal evidence to make a point, which is totally unsound, and I realize that. We've been doing, my wife and I have been doing the Whole Life Challenge, which is essentially a very strict workout and diet deal where you can't eat any kind of processed food or anything like that. And man, it feels great. It's very difficult to figure out how to live like that for the first couple of weeks. But once you start cooking all your food, having it laid out where you can just, you know, heat it up when you get home, and you're eating like mostly organic meat, vegetables, fruit, but even when it's not organic, it's still stuff you made yourself. Man, you feel a lot better just since we went down that Monsanto track.
Yeah. And, is that kind of similar to the paleo stuff, or I guess it's, you don't do the gluten-free stuff necessarily, but it's the same idea?
It's the same idea. Yeah. Whole Life Challenge is gluten-free. It's not paleo in the sense that it's like a little bit, it's actually even a little bit stricter than that. Paleo is, I mean, I guess everybody who eats paleo eats slightly differently and would argue about it. But I don't know if it's the gluten-free aspect of it. I don't know if it's the no chemicals, I can't pronounce aspect of it. I don't know if it's both. But man, as crappy as that is the first couple of weeks, I would just recommend next year when the Whole Life Challenge starts up again for anybody to think about maybe doing it, because it's open to anybody in the world can do it. And it's like $45. You join with like your office or your gym or whatever. They keep a little piece of the pie, and then whoever does the best on the challenge in your group brings home the pot. So you can even make a little money on it.
How do you qualify that? Like, how do you decide who wins?
Every day you go in, they have like an activity log that asks you a couple of questions to see how you did. And so you log your activity every day, and it there's like a point system connected with it. So you have a leaderboard in your group. Oh, here's in the lead. Here's this person. Here's how they did on diet. Here's how they did on exercise and every day, you know, that kind of stuff.
How do you stop people from lying?
You don't join a group with a bunch of liars. I mean,
That works.
I mean, if everybody at your office is a liar, then you guys have bigger problems than worrying about the Whole Life Challenge.
That's true. You might be right, surrounded by evil capitalists that want to sell widgets to customers that explode whenever they open them and kill everybody in the room.
Oh yeah, that would be bad.
Yeah.
So I think I'm gonna wrap up here. Thanks so much for coming out and doing this with us, Corey. I really, really appreciate it. Learned a lot of really interesting stuff. I hope that our listeners will really appreciate this cast too.
Yeah,
it's not something you'd hear every day. So
yeah, I think we got to hear some insights we might not get to hear every day. And there's probably not too much stuff you want to plug. We don't want to, you know, necessarily tie your kind of political leanings and opinions too much to your companies. But so thank you very much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us.
Do you have any anything else you want to throw out there real quick, though? Any last words, piece of advice for people listening?
Man, I feel like all the questions were softball. And, you know, I mean, I definitely make mistakes and, you know, I'm wrong sometimes and, you know, I'm not perfect and I do stupid things from time to time. But, you know, you guys have been really nice to me. I really appreciate that. And just in general, I think if somebody finds out who I am and buys from me on purpose, or if you just happen to buy from me, or if you don't buy from me at all and you only buy from my competitors, I would really advocate thinking about how to spend more time cooking your own food with your friends and family, spending time doing something that's not in front of a screen on your break time. and just see what that does to your health and to your sanity. The other thing is that for anybody who doesn't know, the way this came about is there was a guy who posted for an AMA request for somebody who started their own business and made millions and that kind of deal. And then the guy who took it, actually used regulatory capture to export Apple products to some part of the world where he's the only one who does it. And somebody had put a post on there like, oh, this is capitalism in the 21st century. And I think I got overly upset about it because I just read one too many, you know, articles like that. And kind
that
of
was me. I posted that.
So in any event, that guy definitely has more cash than me, right? I don't want to pretend like I can't go buy a Ferrari with cash, right? All right, that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. But I certainly am fortunate and live well. And I think that it is unfortunate that it is very easy to make a lot of money with regulatory capture. But I don't want that to be a deterrent for somebody, you know, like you guys asked, is there room for somebody in online retail? I don't want that to be a deterrent to anybody who's really passionate about something, to keep them away from doing something. Somebody even posted an article that Mark Cuban or somebody was like, it's not do what you love, it's just working hard. But I think I think he was trying to be controversial. You have to do something that you care about enough to be willing to wake up every day and work harder than anybody else is going to work. But you're the one who has to motivate yourself. So if you love it and you don't work hard, it's not going to work. But if you love it and you're willing to work hard and you're willing to take a chance, I'm a strong believer that entrepreneurship contributes extra freedom to your life. If you can be successful at it, it's very stressful. It's very difficult. But it's not impossible. And I think, you know, we're losing the ability to move from whatever class you were born in to the next level up. But you can still start a business relatively easily. And if you can figure out how to make that work, I highly advocate really considering it, because the things that are really, it's unfortunate that money's important, but it is important. So your ability to make your own way in that regard, and then spending more time with your friends and family so you realize why it is that you're working so hard. But that's what I'd like to leave with.
Okay, great. And so I'd just like to welcome our listeners to check out the archives and track our progress as we continue to spread the message on Decline FM and Decline Estate on iTunes. And I would like to remind you that Decline Estate is still brought to you free of charge, as well as commercial free. And a big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, and of course to Corey for being on with us. Decline Estate is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. So remember, when asked, always decline to state. This is Ron McPaul saying, take a chance and improve yourself today.
This is the Eternal, and a big thanks to Corey Tisdow for coming on, and I hope you guys have a good day.
Wrong Opinion signing off from the Rust Belt. Enjoy the rest of your week, folks.